Matthew chapter 22, verses 37 through 44. Jesus has been asked by one of the Pharisees, which is the greatest commandment? He answered, to love the Lord your God with all your heart, your soul, your mind, and spirit. And the second is like it, to love your neighbor as yourself. Upon these two hang all the law and the prophets. In other words, everything that I have been trying to tell you in 1,500 years since I first asked Moses to pick up a quill is about those two things. Nothing else truly matters. So, first of all, let's take care of the easy one. Love your neighbor as yourself. That's living the Christian life. That's reaching out to every single soul that comes across your path and showing them the kind of love that Jesus did in his everyday walk. The bigger commandment and the tougher one, because we can't see him, and that's why loving your neighbor is so important. They're an extension of our ability to love Christ. But to love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul is about praise. It's about prayer. It's about drawing near to Him so He can draw near to you. But loving the Lord your God with all your mind, that's about developing yourself. That's about developing your biblical literacy. Knowing what's in the Bible. Knowing what His will is. Because of that, I started this series the last time because I truly believe that the Bible is so much more than this, but it is a story. It's a true story, but it is a story. And it's a fascinating, page-turning story. But the difference between it and most novels is as you start out reading a novel, the author develops the characters for you. Well, this is real life. He just introduces you to John by name. He doesn't go into a big description of John or Peter or Andrew or anybody. So you really have to have a more rounded view of the Bible to know who these people are. But I think it is crucial to know because we can understand Jesus better if we think of it as a play and we understand all the different roles of the characters around him, and we understand the background and the setting that he was in, then when he says something, it makes much more sense. So this series has been about fleshing out the apostles. And the last time, we took the first two sets of brothers. It was 12 apostles. There are more than 12 apostles, and there are a lot more disciples. Disciple just means followers. There's hundreds, thousands. We are disciples of Christ. Apostles comes from the Greek apostelos. It means sent ones. It's an emissary. They carry his seal. They carry his authority. There was 12 to begin with. Judas betrayed him. Peter overstepped his bounds and nominated someone else when all the Lord told him to do was wait. But that's true Peter. And then in due time, God nominated his own man in Paul. Paul was the last apostle. So there was actually 14, but we're going to cover the initial 12. It's always broke up into four groups, or three groups of four. Two sets of brothers always lead it. They were the closest to him. Jesus' life shows us that one man cannot truly bond closely with even 12. There was an inner circle inside of that 12. Three of those four were there for everything But those four are always listed first because they were his inner circle. And it was two sets of brothers. The book outside of the Bible that has made me understand this group of men better than anything is a book called 12 Ordinary Men by John MacArthur. And that is the most true statement of the world. It is as if Jesus walked along and said, you, 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 and you. The rest of you can go home. Random. Two sets of brothers, fishermen, no theological training, no nothing. Come on, follow me. It wasn't about them. He doesn't call the equipped. He equips those he calls. None of us are ready for this. I'm certainly not qualified to stand up here and preach. Now, the two sets of brothers were fishermen in business together. Peter and Andrew, we talked about last time. Peter was the chief among all apostles. He was Jesus' chosen leader. And they were the minority partners in the fishing business because they didn't have the money. James and John, we'll be talking about today, had the money. How do we know that? Because they're always listed as sons of Zebedee. They are. Zebedee carried clout from Galilee all the way to Jerusalem. Most church historians think that he was a Levite by birth. Hence his connections with the high priest. We'll get into that later because it comes into very important information late in the Gospels. They were affluent. They had servants, whereas Peter and Andrew just had their boat. And so they were among the first that were called, and they were among the first to meet Jesus. A little bit about their family background. Their father Zebedee, as we said, was a wealthy, influential fisherman. Their mother, her name was Salome. She was a devout woman. She was one of the women who ministered to Jesus. We said that he had many, many disciples. He had hundreds of people who followed him around. He had a group of women who helped financially, who helped prepare meals for everybody, who helped do a lot of things. She was one of these people. She was a very ambitious woman. She was unapologetically an advocate for her sons, as we'll find out. And she was at the cross the day that he died. She's one of the women that is listed in there. Now, James and John are sometimes misunderstood. Jesus referred to them jokingly as sons of thunder, Boanerges. Now, this wasn't like him naming Simon Peter, where he changed his name. This was a nickname. It's only listed once. We don't know how often he used it, but it was to chide them on their little fiery temperament, to kind of get them to, all right, slow down, Speedy. They are often seen together. They apparently were very close, and they were always in the mix every time that, and many times that the Gospels record that the apostles were fighting amongst themselves to see who would be the greatest among them. They were both very strong, dominant personalities. We don't often think of John that way because he was the youngest and because of the way he's rendered in classic art and everything else. But let's start out with James. He's the lesser known brother, although he was the oldest. He was the logical leader of the entire group. He was probably just as big, just as powerful, just as forceful as Peter. And he had money and he had connections. It would seem, and that probably led to a lot of the arguments, it would seem that he would be the logical leader. Jesus had other criteria in mind. He was a very passionate man. We see that in a story where they were coming from Galilee to Jerusalem for a festival. And they went through Samaria. Well, most Jews didn't do that. Most Jews crossed the Jordan, went down the other side, and came back across the Jordan again, went through desert regions just to stay out of Samaria. Why? Samaritans were a Mongol race. When the Assyrians sacked Jerusalem way back, they left some people who were sympathetic to their cause in the land. They intermingled with the Assyrians, which would be like Christians over today siding with ISIS and intermingling with ISIS. That's who the Assyrians were. And ended up taking a bastardized version of Judaism. And they worshipped on Mount Gerizim. They did not like the Jews, did not want to worship with the Jews. The feeling was more than mutual. And so they worshipped on Mount Gerizim, and the Jews worshipped in Jerusalem. Jews didn't want any part of that region, and they didn't want any part of the Jews. So Jesus is crossing through there. And they go into a village looking for a place to stay for the night. And the village says, no, get out. They were offended because Jesus, although they welcomed him, they knew he was going to Jerusalem for the festival. So you're with them and not with us. Okay, you're not welcome. Don't stay here. They're leaving town. John and James are so upset and so frustrated, they say, now bear in mind, in the same region this had happened, they said, do you want us to call down fire on them like Elijah? For those of you who don't know, Elisha was a prophet back in the Old Testament, and in this same region, he had intercepted some people that were sent from the king of Judea in order to... He had sent the king of the king of Judea had sent them out because he had fallen through some lattice work on the roof and hurt himself and was laid up in bed and wanted them to go to the worshipers of Baal-zebub and find out if he was going to recover. Now, Elisha meets them on the way and says, is it because there's not a God in Israel that you seek demonic intervention? Well, this gets back to the king. The king sends a cohort of 50 men to go get him. Go pick him up and bring him to me. Well, Elisha's sitting up on a mountain and says, so, if I'm, they said, man of God, come down and see the king. He said, if I am a man of God, let fire come down and consume you. Burned them up. This happened twice. The third one was actually smart enough to come with some humility and asked him, please would you come down and not burn me? And the rest is history. But this had happened. This had happened because they were going to attack Elisha, and this was God's judgment. With this in mind, James and John says, okay, well, you want us to call down fire on these guys? Well, A, that's arrogance. If Jesus wanted to call down fire, he didn't need your help. And he tells them, you don't know what manner of spirit you are. I came to save these people, not to punish them. But that's the mentality that they had naturally. We also see that Salome had come to them after he had told all the apostles that they would be sitting in judgment over Jerusalem in the kingdom. Salome comes to Jesus and says, Lord, would you give me what I ask you? He said, what do you want from me? She said, for my sons to sit on your right hand and your left hand in the kingdom. They were going around everybody else. We want the premier spots in heaven. And there's quite a bit more to the story. He tells them, basically, you don't know what you're asking for. That's not mine to give. But it made the rest of the apostles mad because they were seeking their own from Jesus. Both of these men were two of the three who were present at three specific times when no one else was, when even the other apostles were locked out. Jairus' daughter was revived from the dead. It was only Peter, James, and John. On the Mount of Transfiguration, when Jesus was transformed and then met with Moses and Elijah, they were the only ones there. And in the internal of the Garden of Gethsemane, the night before he died, when he asked those three to come with him to pray. And then he moved off a little bit from them. Now, James has one other distinction. In 44 AD, he was the first apostle to be martyred. He's the only apostle that the Bible records his death. There was one other martyr before him, Stephen, but he was the first of the apostles to be martyred. And he was martyred by no less a personage than Herod. This isn't the Herod that killed the babies when this is his nephew, Herod Antipas. And we see that in Acts 12, verse 2. There's the account of James's martyrdom. Now, on to John, because we know so much more about John. We know John not by what is said about him in the Bible, but by his own writings. He wrote five of the books of the New Testament. The gospel bearing his name, John 1, 2, and, or 1 John, 2 John, and 3 John, the epistles, and the revelation of Jesus Christ. We are able to really get an accurate picture of him. He was born in 6 AD. So if you do your math, depending on when, there's some discrepancy of whether Jesus died in 30 AD or 33 AD. My inclination is 30 AD because Jerusalem was destroyed 40 years after that, 70 AD. God tends to do things in 40s and 7s. But either way, he was either 21 or 24 years old when he met Jesus. He was the youngest of the apostles. He was a kid. And he was looked upon by Jesus as a kid brother. He was his closest friend. He became known as the apostle of love, but as we've seen through the little things that he and James were involved in, he wasn't always that way. He could be hot-tempered, he could be self-serving, he could be brash, he could be bigoted. But he had the makings of the man that he would become as the older he was, the patriarch of the church. He was wise, other-centered, humble, kind, and loving. Now, the biggest indication of the humility that he learned is in the fact that in his own gospel, he refuses to refer to himself by name. He only refers to himself by the, I love the expression, the apostle whom Jesus loved. That sums him up. Decades and decades later, as he's an old man, what he still can't get over is he loved me. That sums up who John became. He was just filled with awe at Jesus choosing him. The only time that he is mentioned in Scripture alone is another one of his downfalls. They had just been rebuked, and he comes to Jesus and says, there was a man preaching about you, and I rebuked and forbade him because he's not one of us. And Jesus gets on to him and says, look, if they're not against us, they're for us. And that's, you know, you should not have forbade him doing that. let's see. He was the apostle who laid on Jesus' chest the night before he died. Now, that sounds pretty funny in today's ears. But you have to understand the culture. That's what I was saying about the setting around you. In that culture, men were naturally more affectionate to each other than they are now. They kissed each other upon greeting and whatnot. But they also, when they reclined at table, they were not sitting around a table in chairs. They didn't have, they had a table and they would recline around them and they would lay one person's head on another person's feet, and so they'd lay on one elbow and eat with the other hand. And so he's laying in front of Jesus at the Last Supper, and when he wants to hear what Jesus is saying, he just kind of leans his head back up against him and gets the very best possible angle. Now, after Jesus is arrested, we see him again because with his connections to the high priest, he is the one who gets Peter into the high priest's court where he could be close enough to hear the interrogation going on, and where Peter eventually denied Christ three times. It's because he was with John, and John knew people and was gained entry through that. He is the only apostle that we know of that was at the foot of the cross. No one else we don't have any account of another apostle there. And it is while he's at the foot of the cross that Jesus looks down at his mother and his very best friend. And bear in mind, Jesus had one obligation left in the world. He had no children. He had no wife to worry about. But there's his mother. Who's going to take care of her? And he looks down into this man's eyes. And he said, "Woman, behold your son. Son, your care for your mother." And from that day, John took Jesus' mother, Mary, into his home and refused to leave Jerusalem until after she died. Even in the face of massive persecution which scattered the church, he stayed in Jerusalem. He had an obligation. He outlived all the other apostles. Every one of the apostles except him was martyred, including Paul, who wasn't even around at the beginning. But that's not for lack of trying. We'll get to that. He wrote, as we said, 5 books. The Gospel of John, depending on the date that you put on it, was either written sometime before 70 AD when Jerusalem fell, or no later than 85 AD, which would have made him sometime between 67 and 82 years old when he wrote it. 1 John was written sometime between 85 and 90, so he would have been 82 to 87. 2 and 3 John were written in 90, and then Revelation, well, let me back up. After writing 3 John, and all these books were written while he was the pastor in Ephesus. Paul had started a church in Ephesus, and John had taken over. When he left Jerusalem, he had taken over the pastorship there. And he was the patriarch of the church. And what happened was, after he had written the 3 epistles, during this time, Nero had died. Nero took over as an 18-year-old kid and immediately declared himself as God and killed everybody who stood in defiance of that. Therefore, Christians were his sworn enemies. He was the one that put the Christians into the Colosseum. He was the one who dipped them in pitch and used them to light his garden. He was the one who beheaded Paul and crucified Peter upside down. This was Nero. After Nero died at 31 years old, then Domitian, Emperor Domitian, took over. Domitian was not any more humble. He immediately declared himself God. So, during this process, he had pretty much cleansed the world of the original apostles, all except he heard John was in Ephesus, which was in Asia Minor, way away from Rome, but still part of the Roman Empire. So he sends the governor there to go pick him up, and they bring him in, and they promptly boil him in oil. The problem was God wasn't done yet. He still had more for him to do. See, if that attempt on his life had worked, we wouldn't have the book of Revelation. That's a good sign to us. As long as we still have something to accomplish for the Lord, nobody can thwart that. But he was boiled alive in oil and came out unharmed. Then he was exiled to the island of Patmos. The island of Patmos is a small island off the coast of Greece. It is rock. It's like the Alcatraz of the old world. And it's 42 miles around. If you started walking, went all the way around it, 42 miles. Small island. He's exiled there. He lives in a cave. And Jesus appears to him there, and he writes the book of Revelation. Sometime after that, between 95 and 98 AD, he did come back from the Isle of Patmos. He came back to the church at Ephesus, a weary old man who could not walk into the church. We know because he had a young man that he had brought up in the faith, that he had mentored. His name was Polycarp. Polycarp became one of the great fathers of the early church. Polycarp told us that they would carry John in and stand him up to preach toward the end of his life. And he also told us that if you were around him for any length of time, what you would hear him say is, "Little children, love one another." It's this famous quote, "Little children, love one another." And they asked him why. He said, "It was the Lord's directive. And if you only do that, it is enough." I mean, that's John. Little children, love one another. He died in 98 AD among his closest friends and fellow believers. And finally, after a lifetime of burying his friends and watching them go on to glory and living with the pain that he lived with, he was brought into the Lord's bosom in 98 AD, at 92. Well, that is it. Let me close in prayer. Father, we thank you for this opportunity to learn about your followers so that we may understand you better. We thank you for your holy word. We thank you for the opportunities that we have in this country to worship freely. We thank you for this wonderful church family around us, and we ask you to bless them as they go about their week, and as we send them out into your world to do your will. In Jesus' holy name, amen.